Hey folks, Ben Birch here from White Rose Society. I don't usually interrupt your regularly scheduled programming, so I'll keep this brief. I am currently holding a fund drive to keep White Rose on the air. If you think what I do here is valuable, please visit our homepage at www.whiterosesociety.org and chip in to defray the substantial costs of this service. Thank you very much.
As we're indicating, could it be that basically the markets have now discounted the financial sector? Said, okay, that bunch of stocks are going to take a hit. The rest of them, they're in pretty good shape. Pharmaceutical people are still using pharmaceuticals. People are still going to the doctor. People are still buying food. People are still buying gasoline. Or is there something much bigger and larger and more insidious going on here? You know, more dangerous. We'll be getting to that as we continue on through the program today. In our second hour, Barbara Comstock, Republican strategist and former senior campaign advisor to Governor Mitt Romney, is going to be here. We're talking about the Employee Free Choice Act. And Robert Baer, not Bob Barr, but Robert Baer, the author of The Devil We Know, Dealing with the New Iranian Superpower, is going to be here in our third hour. So it should be an interesting day. Hope you can stick around. Right now, Ralph Reed is with us. Ralph Reed, the Republican Uber strategist and author of Dark Horse, his website, ralphreed.com. Dark Horse, the political thriller that first predicted a woman on the national ticket long before there was a woman on the national ticket. Actually, a Republican woman, let's say. Ralph, welcome to the show.
Thanks a lot, Tom. Good to be with you.
Thank you. I'm curious, first of all, your thoughts as the former director of the Christian Coalition on these 33 pastors, Reverend Ron Johnson Jr., apparently really pushing this thing, that they should, in fact, they are breaking, well, it's not really breaking the law, it's breaking the tax code, threatening their tax-exempt status of their churches by being political from the pulpit. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, when I was at the Christian Coalition, we never urged or advocated pastors to endorse candidates from the pulpit. That doesn't mean we didn't think they had the right to do so under the First Amendment. That was just not what we as an organization felt was the most effective way to proceed.
Nobody's saying they don't have the right under the First Amendment. They absolutely have the right under the First Amendment. It's just that they don't have the right to say that you and I are going to pay for their police protection and fire protection and the roads going to the, you know, all of the public services that they get as a result of taxes and not have to pay those taxes.
Yeah, and what I favor is, in order to avoid the death penalty hanging over a church or a religious organization.
Well, losing the tax-exempt status is not a death penalty, right?
Well, it is if you're a charity. I mean, it definitely is a death penalty. You can't function without a tax-exempt status.
Well, you can.
If I could answer.
Sure.
What I would favor, Tom, and I would hope that a lot of people, you know, on the other side of the aisle would agree with this, is just go with what we have currently for a 501c4 public policy organization, which is an insubstantial expenditure of funds of less than 5%. I think if you did that and somebody said something from the pulpit, that's different than putting out yard signs or running TV ads.
But isn't that the camel's nose under the tent? I mean, basically what the deal that we made in 1954 with churches, first of all, the reason churches got tax-exempt status in the first place is because, like schools and hospitals and other organizations that provide necessary public services, we as a people decided that, you know, it's an important enough thing. Religion is an important enough thing in American public life that we're going to subsidize it. We're going to pay for their police protection. We're going to pay for their fire protection. They're not going to have to pay for that. We're going to subsidize that. And in exchange for that, all we want them to do is stay out of the political arena, which, by the way, is you know, where the terms of those subsidies are determined. What's wrong with that?
Well, first of all, police and fire protection is a local function. What we're talking about is a federal income tax deduction.
But churches don't pay local property taxes either because of their 501c1.
That's determined at the local level. It also depends upon the use of the land, as you know.
I've been on the board of a 501c3 for 35 years, Ralph. You don't pay local property taxes if you choose not to, pretty much anywhere in the United States.
And look, as I've said, what I favor is allowing an insubstantial amount of such activity, which for a 501c4 organization is less than 5%.
Right.
Now, you and I may disagree on that, and I understand that. All I'm saying is I don't see the point, Tom, in a $50 million charity that's helping lots of people heal marriages, help the poor, help people get GED equivalency degrees and things of that nature, to lose their tax-exempt status because one guy got up at a pulpit and said, vote for Bob.
Yeah.
That's all I'm saying.
Okay, point made. In 1998, when you were working with Jack Abramoff bringing casino money into Alabama through the Christian Coalition to defeat Don Siegelman's lottery proposal that would fund education, what was Karl Rove's role in that?
None.
You never discussed any of this with Karl Rove?
No.
Interesting. Okay.
And incidentally, I might add, just in the interest of fairness,
sure,
the effort that we undertook through the Alabama pro-family movement to defeat Don Siegelman's lottery plan did not involve a dime of revenue derived from gambling activity. That was later determined by outside auditors. Unfortunately, on the other side of the aisle, where the money was raised for the lottery plan, as you know, there were multiple convictions in federal trials for that activity, and
right.
It was found to have been corrupt.
Jack Abramoff. Well, there are a lot of people who are alleging.
No, I'm saying on the other side of the aisle.
Okay. Yeah.
One of the donors to Siegelman's political committee went to prison, and
right.
Siegelman was convicted. Now,
right.
his conviction, as you know, Tom, is on appeal. But I've always found it kind of interesting that we get criticized because we defeated the lottery plan, and it was people on the other side who were found to have been corrupt and ultimately went to prison.
Well, and that, which raises a good question, because there were a number of Republicans who were also investigated at the same time for the exact same thing and were never prosecuted. And in fact, you're one of the names that was prominently omitted from some of the subpoenas that came down the road. I know you were subpoenaed in one case, but you were not subpoenaed in the Shields and Cragen's study, as it were. And was the U.S. Attorney's Office selectively prosecuting Democrats and not Republicans in those cases?
You know, I certainly don't have any evidence to believe that that's the case. And as I said, it's ultimately going to be a matter that's going to be resolved by the courts. But Don Siegelman was convicted by a jury of his peers, as was Richard Scrushy, and this was thoroughly looked into, and the case was that positions on state boards were effectively sold in exchange for campaign contributions to people who would benefit from the regulation of the boards that they were appointed to.
You're talking about Scrushy. This is a guy who had been on the hospital board under two previous administrations, Republican administrations. It was
right.
A voluntary position for which he was not paid, and he turned it down. Don Siegelman asked him to do it. Either you're not familiar with this, or you're mischaracterizing it, Ralph.
All I'm saying is what happened. You know, it is on the
right, and that's my question: is what happened the consequence of Karl Rove corrupting the political process by not prosecuting people like yourself, who seem to have been involved in money laundering, conspiracy, campaign finance violations, mail fraud, and other misdeeds? I mean, those are some of the implications, and selectively prosecuting Democrats. Do you have any information or any evidence that that might be the case?
No.
And how can you say that that's not the case when for example, Scrushy goes to jail for doing exactly what he did with a Republican governor prior to that, and nobody ever looked into the Republicans? Don Siegelman goes to jail for putting this guy on a board to which no benefit accrued to Don Siegelman or to Scrushy.
You know, look, my analysis of it is I think there are bad actors in both parties. And I think nobody has a monopoly on either vice or virtue. There have been a number of Republican members of Congress, including former Congressman Duke Cunningham and former Congressman Bob Ney, who ended up being either convicted or pleading guilty and were punished accordingly.
Well, even Bob Ney now is suggesting that.
It's also happened on the Democratic side of the aisle. So I don't think any party here can claim, you know, we're perfect and we don't have
Well, I get that, but Bob Ney is now even claiming that he was the, he speaks Farsi, that he was the guy who brought the information from Iran that they were willing to recognize Israel and stop all nuclear development, and delivered that in writing to the Bush administration, and then boom, a ton of bricks falls on him.
I that's the first I've heard that. I don't know anything about that comment.
I'd suggest you call Bob Ney and ask him about it, but... Anyhow, Ralph Reed, he's the author of Dark Horse. RalphReed.com is his website. The first political thriller. Dark Horse predicted the first woman on the national ticket, first one since 1984. And, Ralph, thanks for dropping by.
Thank you, Tom. Good to be with you.
Good talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program here on Air America Radio.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Past the hour. Well, we narrowly escaped owning our soul to the Chinese yesterday. Don Siegelman is with us, the former Democratic governor of Alabama, and a subject of some of my conversation with Ralph Reed just a moment ago. And DonSiegelman.org or DonSiegelman.com, his website's it's I before E, Don Siegelman. And Governor, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you, Tom. I'm glad to be here. Glad you had an opportunity to talk to Ralph Reed.
Did you have an opportunity to hear it by any chance?
No, I did not. But,
I asked him straight up in 1998, was he working, when he was then working with Abramoff to bring casino money into Alabama through the Christian Coalition to defeat your lottery, did Karl Rove play a role in it? And he said, no, not at all. And then I asked him if he felt that the Justice Department was selectively prosecuting Democrats over Republicans, and cited your case and Mr. Scrushy for as examples. He went on at some length about how you guys were convicted in a court of law. And I said, you know, for doing exactly what the Republicans before had done, which is appointing somebody to a non-paying hospital board. I mean, come on, give me a break, Ralph. And asked him if there was any prosecutorial misconduct, in his opinion, on prosecuting Democrats and not Republicans. And I guess, predictably, he said no, he didn't think so.
Yeah, I was going to say, let me guess his answer.
Yeah, yeah. But I wanted to get it on the record. I was frankly curious to see how he would respond to those questions. And although he, you know, Ralph's a pro, he comported himself well. What's going on with your case? What's going on with this whole thing? The bigger question, what's going on with holding Karl Rove in contempt of Congress for, unlike Ralph Reed, refusing to answer questions about that? Well, actually, Ralph wasn't under oath, so I guess it doesn't much matter what he said on the air. But Karl Rove is refusing to answer questions under oath on these same questions.
Well, Karl Rove has been all over the board on answering his answer to that question. He has at first said that he would answer questions, but then he said he wouldn't answer them under oath, and he wouldn't answer them if anybody was there to take down his answers. And then when he was subpoenaed, he didn't show up at all.
Right.
We are now in the last days of this congressional session, and we've got one last shot at holding Karl Rove in contempt. It is important, I think, for your listeners, if they will, to make one last phone call to Nancy Pelosi's office, one last phone call to their own congressman, and ask their member of Congress to rattle the cage of the leadership and say, after you vote on this bailout package, bring the contempt citation for Karl Rove up for a vote so we can bring him before the Judiciary Committee and put him under oath.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And callcongress.org, by the way, is a website that we set up that has a bunch of 800 numbers so you can call Congress painlessly, as well as the main 202 number for the exchange. And you simply ask for your member of Congress. If you're not sure who represents you in the House of Representatives, and some people don't know, just give them your zip code or tell them what state, you know, tell them what city you live in, and the zip code will do it. And the operators there are very knowledgeable. They'll track it, that person down and connect you right directly to their office. So
we've got this one last shot, and I think we ought to go ahead and take it. We've come a long way. The House Judiciary Committee has recommended that Roe be held in contempt. Recently, Attorney General McCasey, under pressure, has appointed a special prosecutor. The Inspector General has issued a report underlining the wrongdoing, illegal activity that's been going on at the Department of Justice and politicizing that department, using it as a political weapon. And the Inspector General has said he's not finished with his investigation yet. So all of the hard work that your listeners have been doing in their emails and their letters and their phone calls has really paid off and has taken us to where we are today. We're right at the critical point where one vote of Congress can bring Karl Rove to the Judiciary Committee to be held accountable for his sins.
Mm-hmm. And this is so important. Contemptforrove.com or .org as well. DonSiegelman.com or .org or contemptforrove.com. You can send an email to your member of Congress, although, frankly, emails have 1/1,000th the impact, if that, of a phone call. And callcongress.org will get you all the phone numbers. But we're talking with former Alabama Governor Don Siegelman and one of the victims of the corruption of the Justice Department, in my humble opinion. I've done a hell of a lot of research on this thing. And there are others out there, Paul Miner, Richard Scrushy. Frankly, I think at some level, maybe even Bob Ney, a bunch of people, although he clearly committed some crimes. But the subordination of justice by this Justice Department is terrible. DonSiegelman.com, contemptforrove.com. Governor, thank you for being with us.
Oh, thank you so much, Tom. Look forward to seeing you.
Keep up the great work. It's 27 minutes past the hour. We'll be back with What's Going on Wall Street.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-303-2270.
Okay, so the Fed, this Edmund Andrews and Mark Landler, writing in the New York Times today, the Fed on Monday announced that it would provide an extra $150 billion through an emergency lending program for banks, an additional $330 billion through so-called swap lines with foreign central banks. This is on top of the $230 billion that they borrowed last week to prop up AIG, the big insurance company that would have taken down Goldman Sachs had it gone down, which, of course, is Henry Paulson's old company. He made $700 million working there. The Fed, they note in the New York Times article, Andrews and Landler, can lend money to any company it deems too dangerous to fail by invoking the same Depression-era law. We're still being protected by Franklin Roosevelt. We're still being protected by Franklin Roosevelt.
Roosevelt is dead! His policies may live on, but we're in the process of doing something about that as well.
Yeah, Rush, when you said that back 4 years ago, a couple of years ago, that was true. And look what it brought us. Anyhow, they point this out. Yields on three-month Treasury bills shrank to 0.29%. What does that mean? That means that everybody that means that the very wealthy in the United States, and it was interesting to see Mort Zuckerman on TV last week, the last weekend, where he was, he was worth $3 billion. And he was asked, where's your money now? And he said, it's all in treasuries, or words to that effect. The very wealthy are taking their money out of pretty much everything and putting it into treasuries, even though they only return 0.25% a year. In other words, they're actually losing money because inflation is running at, technical inflation, 3.5%, 4%, real inflation, 6%, 7%, 8%. Interbank lending rates climbed to new highs on Monday. In other words, banks are finding it harder to borrow money from other banks. Now, who does this hit mostly? This hits small banks. And let me tell you just a personal story about this. Now, back in 1978, I wrote a book about this called The Prophet's Way. Back in 1978, Louise and I started a charity in New Hampshire, a community for abused kids. It's called the New England Salem Children's Village. And it's still there. It's still running. It's been running all these 30 years this year, I guess. And we, when we put this thing together, a lot of charities, you put them together and you get a bunch of local rich folks on the board and get them to contribute money every year and build a big endowment. And we never did that, which was probably ultimately, looking back in retrospect, a mistake. But we didn't do it because in middle of rural New Hampshire, there pretty much aren't any famous rich folks. And what we really wanted on our board were people who cared about what was going on, cared about the kids. And so anyhow, the way that the organization works, the state of New Hampshire pays for the placement of kids. These are kids who can't make it in foster care. In fact, when I was working there, one of the intakes we did, this kid had been through over 32 foster homes. The kids who can't make it in foster care, and if there wasn't a program like ours, they would end up in the children's prison or the state mental hospital. And this is a really great program. No more than 8 kids. Actually, right now, it's no more than 6 kids in a home with 2 house parents. And there's therapy. It's a vegetarian program, whole foods diet. It's a great program for kids. And it's one of the best in the country. And it's been serving these kids for 30 years. And the state pays, sometimes 30 days, sometimes 60 days, some days 90 days, sometimes not anywhere near as much as they need. And so we rely on donations to some extent, but mostly in order to make payroll and things while we're waiting for the state payments to come in, we rely on a line of credit from the bank. And last week, the executive director went to the small local bank in New Hampshire and said, okay, we need to roll over the line of credit because we've got payroll coming. And they said, we don't have any money. We can't, as it's still, there's still a possibility of this happening in a week and a half from now, we'll find out. It's been escalated all the way up. But the normal process of simply rolling over a line of credit, which is already granted, has been stopped by this bank. And it's not because the banks are bad guys. It's because they can't get, these small local banks can't get money from the big banks to loan to organizations that have, a lot of assets and are doing very well. So I'm, my job now is to try and raise, we got to come up with $40,000 for payroll for the next month or two. And so if you're inclined to contribute money to a good charity that is absolutely tax deductible, it's SalemChildrensVillage.org is the website. SalemChildrensVillage.org. Children's is plural. But in any case, that's just, this is how this thing comes home. And it's going to be coming home, this got pushed in my face yesterday. It's going to be coming home right across the board as the credit markets freeze up. This is frankly not about the stock market, although the stock market lost $1.2 trillion in wealth yesterday. Things like that happen. That's not as big a drop as happened in 87, and we made it through just fine. Although that, you could argue, was in response to early Reaganomics. This is late stage Reaganomics. This is stage 5 Reaganomics. But it means that it's going to be harder to borrow money. It's going to be harder for companies, businesses to borrow money, just like it is harder for the Salem Children's Village to borrow money. And, arguably, maybe down the road, you could say, looking back in the Great Depression, it's a good thing. We're going to be forced to go out and start aggressively raising money, something that we haven't done for years. and we probably should have been doing. And build an endowment. And people are going to be forced to come up with a larger down payment for their homes. And businesses are going to be forced to have more operating capital. And I'd say over the long term, that's a good thing. Over the short term, when it's sprung on you, it's a disaster. For example, in New Hampshire, I mean, in 4 weeks, if we can't make payroll, you know, we're going to have to dump a bunch of kids in the state mental hospital or the children's jail. Or what? I don't know. I don't know what the state's going to do with these kids. But it'll be a tragedy and a disaster. And that's just one little story. I guarantee you right now, all over the United States, there are thousands of small, probably tens of thousands of small businesses and small charities that are facing the exact same problem. And big businesses are going to be facing it soon. So we do need to do something about this. But the bailout that was proposed yesterday, frankly, in my opinion, would not have solved that problem because it didn't directly address the underlying issue, which is that the money from the bottom up is not percolating up in this economy. At the end of this New York Times article, they got to the real juicy information, and I noticed that our local paper picked up the New York Times article, but they didn't print the end part, which is a common thing. Very often papers will pick up things in the New York Times and just not print the very end. The very end of this article, in it's right in the front page of today's New York Times, the electronic edition, Treasury and Fed looking at options. At the very end, they note that the Federal Reserve has stretched its resources to the limit. In other words, they're trying to solve this problem by dumping money into the credit markets. Before the crisis began in August of 2007, this is a little over a year ago, they had $800 billion in reserves, nearly all of it in Treasury securities. They had to fork out $300 billion of it. So, well, here's the article. But because of all the new lending programs for banks and Wall Street firms, in other words, bailing out the big guys, analysts estimate that the Fed's balance sheet now has less than $300 billion in unfettered reserves. Now, here's where it gets tricky. The Fed, the central bank, can expand its reserves at will because it controls the money supply and can create more to buy things like Treasury securities and mortgage-backed securities. In other words, the Fed could simply do this. The problem is that if they do that, and this is me talking, not the New York Times, if they do that, expand the money supply like crazy like that, then what they do is they debase the currency. The money supply should only expand as fast as the economy expands so that the dollar maintains a steady value. If the money supply is larger than the size of the economy by 5% in a particular year, then you have a 5% depreciation in the value of the dollar. The value of the dollar goes down by 5% if there's 5% more dollars chasing the exact same amount of goods and services. It's real simple. So the Fed, you know, the Fed can do this. They could just print the money. But as the New York Times quotes Ken Rogoff, economist at Harvard, he says, as long as foreigners have a lot of confidence in our ability to solve our problems, we can borrow $2 trillion. The real constraint is not a bookkeeping one, he says. It's a sense of faith on the part of foreigners that the U.S. government will repay its debt. And that's the thing. If the U.S. credit gets reclassified as something other than AAA, then we're in deep trouble. Particularly given that, you know, Feds, that the treasuries are returning less than a quarter, or about a quarter of a percent, 0.29% right now, meaning everybody's moving, all the big guys, all the millionaires and billionaires are moving their money into treasuries. And I'm thinking about it too. In other words, it's moving it into cash. And actually go to the bank and say, you know, okay, put my money in this, or go to your broker and say, you know, buy these treasuries and give me the physical piece of paper, because I'm not sure that your doors are going to be open tomorrow. I mean, that's what serious, savvy investors are doing. In the meantime, Bush...
We're at a critical moment for our economy. And we need legislation that decisively addresses the troubled assets now clogging the financial system.
And that's the problem, is the clogging of credit. 45 minutes past the hour.
Watch live video of the Tom Hartman program at hartmanradio.com. We'll be right back.
9.5 minutes before the hour. Yeah, Elizabeth Bochner, an 87-year-old former school teacher, claims she has a note to Santa written by Vice President Dick Cheney, who attended her second grade class at Calvert Elementary School when the Cheneys lived in Lincoln, Nebraska. She remembers the vice president as a strange little boy who never smiled. He used to spend time by himself watching the other pupils, spying on them, actually, Bochner said. Bochner discovered the note in an old trunk in the attic. She intends to take the proceeds from the sale of the list to help pay for her hip operation, as she has no health insurance. The note begins with the phrase, "Listen up, Santa," and lists 10 requests for Christmas, including a rifle, not the air kind, but the real, but with real bullets that you can put an eye out with if you want to, a secret underground hideout to make secret plans, and a set of soldiers, not the toy kind, but real ones, so I can take over the world if I want to. The note ends with, "And no funny stuff, Santa, like a lump of coal this year." I must admit, Bochner said, I was relieved when the Cheneys moved to Wyoming, especially after Dickie said something that if I didn't give him a passing grade, my little dog Fluffton might end up in his final throes. Ed Wharton, a handwriting expert, doubts the authenticity of the note. I've examined it thoroughly, he said, and this surely wasn't written by Mr. Cheney, as the author of this note is clearly a heartless sociopath who fits the profile of a mass murderer or a war criminal. A spokesman for the vice president said that Cheney denies the note was his. I never believed in that Santa propaganda, he said. Cheney added that there are no hard feelings, and to prove that, he would like to personally show Mrs. Bochner the rifle he eventually did get for Christmas. Yeah. No, actually, that's from PTSD1.blogspot.com. A little tongue-in-cheek humor from the Post-Times Sun-Dispatch and Mr. Shulman. 866-303-2270, your telephone number. Ian in San Francisco. Hey, Ian, what's on your mind today?
Hello, Tom.
Hey, Ian.
Yeah, what I wanted to say is obviously there is some kind of problem here in the economy. But clearly also is that no one in America believes President Bush, and most especially his Republican colleagues in the House of Representatives.
Well, you know, there's a new theory that Newt Gingrich was behind shooting this thing down and that this was the opening salvo of his Gingrich for President 2012 campaign.
Interesting. Well, you know, what tells me that it's not as serious as the president says and as Paulson says is this. A couple of things. One is I haven't received anything from my credit card company telling me I can't spend as much as I want.
I received a note in the mail last week from my bank about a line of credit that I have, just a personal line of credit, that said that if we don't use it within 12 months, it'll be canceled, and that the old ceiling has been eliminated, and that there is now a floor, a minimum amount, rather than a maximum amount. So I suspect that they're changing things around, but the credit card companies are still pushing credit.
No problem. And let me just throw in one other thought. If this was as serious as they say, that the sky is going to fall, that every minute we waste in not getting a solution could lead to ultimate disaster, do you think they would have taken the day off for Rosh Hashanah?
Yeah, it's a good question, Ian. It's a very good question.
It's nonsense.
I mean, Rosh Hashanah is an important holiday, particularly to Jews, but it's not, taking the day off from Congress. I think, frankly, a couple of days to see what the world markets say. I think it's entirely possible. Thank you, Ian, for the call. I think it's entirely possible that what we're seeing here, as I think I said at the beginning of the show, is that the financial sector has been discounted now. You know, it's going to take a hit. It's going to lose some money. And so the stocks are down. The financial sector's stocks are down. But they're still making pharmaceuticals. Hospitals are still running. Doctor's offices are still running. People are still buying food. People are still buying gas. But on the other hand, if you seize up credit, you could have a problem. Chuck in Miami. Hey, Chuck.
Yeah, hey, Tom. Look here. Love your show, man. But I'm looking at these markets, man, and we all agree that there's some convoluted stuff going on in the markets. We say that. And most people don't really understand what's going on. Even the people that are in the know can't say that they really know what's going on. But you can extrapolate some things. I mean, you have to extrapolate from the point of view that wherever the market is going to land today or tomorrow, it's been there before.
Sure.
And the credit markets didn't shut down. Explain to me why, if the credit markets go back to where they've been and we function fine, that the world's going to collapse now.
Well, it's not. What's going to happen is a whole lot of wealth that was created is going to vanish, and a lot of that wealth has landed in the hands of some very, very wealthy people. As Bernie pointed out, the 400 richest people in America over the last 7 years saw their wealth go from $1 trillion to $1.6 trillion. So their $600 billion
exactly.
may vanish.
They have more money than they're going to ever spend.
Right. And
well,
how's
it going to hurt them for them to lose that money?
It's right. And here's Henry Paulson sitting on the 700. Thank you, Chuck. Well said. Here's Henry Paulson sitting on the $700 million that he made as chairman of Goldman Sachs. Might have been depreciated a little bit, but he didn't even have to pay income tax on that money because he went to work for the feds. And he's running around saying the sky is falling. We've got to save Goldman Sachs. What are they doing in Europe? This from this morning's Wall Street Journal. The European Union's top markets official is preparing an overhaul of banking regulations across the continent as Europe struggles to deal with its own wave of bank failures. And then they point out over the weekend the UK nationalized Bradford and Bingley, and in the Benelux countries, Netherlands, Belgium, and Luxembourg, they injected 11.2 billion euros, that's what, 16 billion US dollars, into Fortis. Its shares are down, by the way. And on Monday, the German government confirmed it had a consortium of commercial banks are providing $35 billion as a rescue package to Hypo Real Estate Holding AG. It's a real estate lender. The company is basically making real estate loans. So the Europeans are looking at this, and they're saying this is a failure of regulation. And frankly, the two countries that are being hit the hardest by this failure of regulation are the two countries who were led by right-wing ideologues, Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan, right-wing ideologues who launched a 30-year campaign of deregulation. The rest of Europe, by and large, did not deregulate. They've been doing, some of the countries, you know, Germany, France, to some extent, they've been doing this in small incremental amounts, and many of the new countries, the new European countries, the former Soviet republics, right out of the gate came in with advice from the Chicago School economists with very little regulation, and they're in deep trouble. But the big countries that never deregulated, they're doing fine, thank you very much.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
I'm pointing out that American Express was cutting back 10.7% the amount of credit that they were offering on their credit cards. Washington Mutual, 9.5%. Target, 3.1%. Wells Fargo, 3.4%. HSBC, 3.1%, making it harder to get credit. And in fact, the article, the headline of the article, banks trimming limits for many on credit cards. The easy money that let Americans depend on credit cards to pay their bills is starting to dry up. This is in June 21st, by Eric Dash. This, the seize up, the slowdown of the credit markets starting, well, it really started about a year ago. It started to become visible, and we started talking about it on this program. I've been talking about economics on this program forever. So, anyway, we'll get back to that in a few minutes. Barbara Comstock is with us. She is a Republican strategist, former senior campaign advisor to Governor Mitt Romney. She represents the Workforce Fairness Institute, an organization committed to educating voters, employers, employees, and citizens about issues affecting the workplace, in particular the dangers of the Employee Free Choice Act, in your mind, Barbara. Do I have that right?
Great, yes. Yes, good to be with you.
Thank you. And SaveTheElection.com, I believe, is your website?
Yes, it is indeed.
Okay. Here's the question I have for you. Why are you opposed to people registering to vote?
Oh, actually, we are not opposed to that. We are... What the Employee Free Choice Act would do is we're opposed to the bill because it would strip employees of their right to vote. Right now, when you're in a union organizing election, you'd no longer have a secret ballot and a right to vote. What would happen is, under this really misnamed bill, union organizers could go around and ask people to sign cards saying they want a union, and when they reach 50% plus one, then they present those cards to the employer, and the employer would have to declare a union.
Right.
Right now, what you have
and
to
then,
do...
And then you have to have a series of secret elections where the union management is elected, where the...
No, actually, under this bill, there would be no elections. That's what is so insidious about the bill, is it eliminates that election process.
No, the members still have... I'm sorry, the members still have to vote for their management. They still have to vote on contracts. And these are secret votes. What card check does is the same thing that happens if I decide that I want to participate in the ultimate union, the United States of America, the union that Ben Franklin and Thomas Jefferson referred to as the union, If I want to participate in that, I go down to the county clerk's office or the secretary of state's office, and I say, I want to register to vote. And my name is Tom Hartman, and I live in Multnomah County, and I live in Portland, Oregon, and I'm, in fact, registering as a Democrat or a Republican.
And when you vote, you get to,
and it's all very public,
vote secretly.
When I vote on my leadership, I get to vote secretly. And when I vote on ballot initiatives, I get to vote secretly. And so will union members.
No, union people, whether or not to have that union, that vote will be eliminated.
That's not a vote. That's registering to vote.
No, that is, no, not at all. That is, you are in a workplace and you have a vote on whether you want a union to be in your workplace or not. Right now, there is a right to a secret ballot in that process. This bill will eliminate that. And this bill is so extreme that even a liberal icon like George McGovern opposes it on principle because he calls it an undemocratic, a disturbing and undemocratic overreach.
So you found one liberal to oppose the bill, huh?
Well, because it eliminates the secret ballot. It's
Barbara, the biggest problem, I think, that the main opponents to this, the National Chambers of Commerce, the National Association of Manufacturers, Walmart, I know of no small business organizations that are genuinely made up of small businesses who are opposing this.
The NFIB is full of small businesses.
National Federation of Independent Businesses is dominated by large corporations. There are virtually no small business organizations left anymore.
Well,
They've all been taken over.
And the $400 million that the unions are putting in, those are small little guys, right? I mean,
well, they are actually. Unions are democratic institutions, and corporations are kingdoms.
Pay, you know, every week you have union bosses getting busted for, you know, using all these dues wrong and embezzling.
Barbara, I now work for a company. Clear Channel, that is owned by Bain Financial, which is run by Mitt Romney, or was, and you're
Mitt
a former
Romney
boss.
Mitt Romney does not run Bain Capital anymore.
Okay, well, he did at one time, as I said.
Back in the 90s.
Right. And
Long before it had anything to do with Clear Channel. So.
Helped found it, right. Yeah, sure. But
you're making leaps of logic.
No, you haven't heard my logic yet. I was setting up an argument, but I'm not trying to pick on Mitt Romney at all. What I'm saying is, as an employee of this company, I have no vote in who the CEO is. This is not a democratic institution.
But if there is going to be a union in place in your workplace, you currently have a right to a secret ballot because a union, if you want to vote for a union, that's great. You have a right to vote for it. But right now, you get to decide in a secret ballot whether a union will come in and they can start taking dues out of your pay. That is something that can fundamentally change your workplace for the good or for the bad. And right now, under the law, you have a right to engage in debate and understand that process, and then just like when you vote for president or senator or congressman, you go in and you secretly vote, and your boss doesn't know how you voted for or against. You can come out and tell your boss, you know what, I voted against that union, even though you voted for it. That's the beauty of the secret ballot. There's no intimidation from the union or from the workplace. It's secret.
But
nobody
this,
knows how you vote for
this
it.
This is not a vote for the management
win.
Of the union.
No, but unions,
back to your earlier point, unions are democratic institutions. Corporations are not. I have employees. I can fire them.
Democratically. You are. If somebody tried to eliminate, if I said, listen, you don't need to vote in Virginia where I live. I went around and collected 50% of the people who would vote in Virginia. I knocked on their door. I got them to sign a card. We don't need to have an election on November 4th because I've already got 50% of the Virginians are going to vote for my guy.
That's
so
deciding whether or not
you're
going to be a member of the United States of America. That's deciding whether or not you're going to participate
this
in democracy. Once you have
workplace.
The union, that union will not exist 2 weeks when they hold the secret ballot. Once people have registered to vote in the union by card check,
but you don't think it's a
once they hold the actual secret ballot election, if people can't agree on management, if they can't agree on the contract, and those are all secret votes, then it's going to die. That union's going to go away. No. You guys can still sabotage
whether
it.
The fundamental question, and that's why George McGovern even recognizes as someone who is a strong...
I don't think George McGovern understands this issue.
Yes, he does understand it. He's written about it and talked about it extensively because he also happens to be a small business owner, and he understands that unions can be good in some situations and they can be bad in some situations, and that the individual employee has a right to decide and has that sacred ballot and right to decide whether a union will come in.
The individual employee has the right to register to vote. And registration for voting is not a secret process. Registering to be a member of a union should not be a secret process.
That is totally false. That is totally false because this bill eliminates the vote on whether a union itself will exist in your workplace. And that is the vote that you are being stripped of, whether it exists. And you're saying,
and a fine thing it is,
force the union on you, but hey, you'll get to decide who's going to be the boss of who's taking the $600 out of your paycheck. No, the union will already be there and you will have had no say if they can collect the cards. Just like if I went around Virginia or my congressional district and get, hey, there's 10,000 people registered to vote.
You realize, Barbara, you're making the same argument that libertarians make against democracy. When libertarians say democracy is fundamentally unfair and should be replaced by capitalism.
I'm sorry, you're against the secret ballot in union elections.
I am in favor of people registering to vote. I'm in favor of publicly declaring that I am registered to vote or publicly declaring that I am in favor of a union. Yes, absolutely. I want to register a union with my company. Then I want a secret vote about who's going to be the leadership of that union, how that union is run, what positions that union is going to take, and whether or not I approve or disapprove of that contract.
Union, and so you don't mind if a union comes in and muscles its way in with no secret ballot vote. You are absolutely...
Doesn't bother me a bit if people register to have a union in public. No, doesn't bother me a bit. I think, in fact, it's a good thing. It's the same way we do it with our democracy here in the United States.
No, we publicly register to vote. No, we vote in a secret.
You didn't
ballot.
Publicly register to vote, Barbara?
We secretly vote on.
Did you publicly register to vote or not?
No, you are mixing apples and oranges. And
I am not. You publicly decided you wanted to participate in our republic, right?
Honestly, talking about what this bill.
No, seriously, you publicly announced that you wanted to participate in American democracy by registering to vote. What's wrong with publicly announcing you want to participate in a union by registering to vote?
No, that is because you vote on whether there is a union existing, and that is what you are stripping voters in the Employee Free Choice Act. And
I would suggest to you, if enough people in America stopped registering to vote, our republic would cease to exist, too.
Well, you can keep misrepresenting the bill, but you don't understand what it is. And
okay. Barbara Constance.
And you'll have $600 taken out of your paycheck.
SaveTheElection.com is our website.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, Somali pirates, this from the wire services, who stunned the world by seizing a Ukrainian ship in the Gulf of Aden, announced today they would take a brief hiatus from terrorizing the high seas out of respect for the Jewish holidays. To all our Jewish friends, we say a hearty Shana Tova, said pirate spokesman Sugli, moments before the pirates hoisted a Star of David flag over the captured ship. Sugli took pains to indicate that while the pirates are taking their Rosh Hashanah break from their usual plundering and pillaging schedule, they are doing so only out of respect for Jewish pirates, and not because they are Jewish themselves. None of us are Somali pirates are Jewish, he said, except for Abe in accounting, who's half. In a related story, former President Bill Clinton, who said earlier he would not campaign for Barack Obama until after the Jewish high holidays, announced today that he would extend his hiatus until Purim, which falls on March 10th, 2009. Responding to Mr. Clinton's decision to remain on the sidelines until 4 months after the elections, Senator Obama issued the following terse statement, "Oy!" Thanks to Andy Borowitz, BorowitzReport.com, for a little levity here today. 22 minutes past the hour, 866-303-2270, our telephone number. The bailout bill is dead. Long live the bailout bill. Is that, the king is dead. Long live the king. By the way, George Bush had no plan whatsoever to catch bin Laden. This from Interpress Services over the byline of Gareth Porter, who is an investigative journalist and investigative historian. He also wrote a book called Perils of Dominance, Imbalance of Power on the Road to Vietnam. is new evidence from former United States officials reveals that Osama bin Laden and other al-Qaeda leaders were able to skip Afghanistan for Pakistan unimpeded in the first weeks after 9/11 because the George W. Bush administration failed to block their retreat. Top administration officials instead gave priority to planning for war with Iraq. Because it had not been directed to plan for the contingency of pursuing bin Laden, the U.S. military was also forced to turn down an offer from then-Pakistani President Pervez Musharraf in late November 2001 to send 60,000 troops to intercept the al-Qaeda leaders. The article goes on at some length. You can find it over at the Asia Times, atimes.com. Actually, you can probably find it anywhere if you Google it, but that's where I got it. Had the Bush administration's priority been to capture or kill the al-Qaeda leadership, it would have deployed the necessary ground troops and airlift resources in the theater over a period of months before the offensive in Afghanistan began. The views of Bush's key advisors, however, ruled out any such plan from the start. During the summer of 2001, keep in mind this is pre-9/11, Rumsfeld refused to develop contingency plans for military action against al-Qaeda in Afghanistan, despite the National Security Presidential Directive that called for such planning, according to the 9/11 Commission report. Rumsfeld and Deputy Defense Secretary Paul Wolfowitz resisted such planning for Afghanistan because they were hoping that the White House would move quickly on military intervention in Iraq. And here's where it gets really, truly bizarre. According to the 9/11 Commission, this is not Andy Borowitz, this is a straight-up news story. According to the 9/11 Commission, at four deputies' meetings on Iraq, this is all before 9/11. First year of the Bush administration. Four deputies' meetings on Iraq between May 31st and July 26, 2001, Wolfowitz pushed his idea to have U.S. troops seize all the oil fields in southern Iraq. After 9/11, Rumsfeld, Wolfowitz, and Vice President Dick Cheney continued to resist any military engagement in Afghanistan because they were hoping for war against Iraq instead. Bush's top-secret order of September 17 for war with Afghanistan also directed the Pentagon to begin planning for an invasion of Iraq. And that's why we couldn't pursue bin Laden, because we didn't have the resources and because we had been specifically, our military had been specifically directed not to put those resources into Afghanistan, but instead to put them into Iraq. So even when bin Laden was there, even when he was in our sights, even when Pervez Musharraf was saying, hey, I got 60,000 troops, I'll loan you. All I need is some ground support, tactical support, logistical support. We didn't have it because we were moving it all into Iraq. Now, Barack Obama says we took our eye off the ball. Boy, did we ever. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. Joe in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Joe, what's on your mind today?
I wanted to talk about the bailout plan. I'm really happy it was defeated. One of the untold stories here is the repo market, where investment banks access cash from global corporations and substitute collateral in the form of T-bills and mortgage-backed securities. Well, guess what? Now that the mortgage-backed securities have dropped in value, the collateral is insufficient. The investment banks can't pay back the loans because they're losing money on the mortgage-backed securities. So, in essence, we're bailing out global corporations.
Well, absolutely.
Makes sense.
That was what it was all about. And that's why, and this is, again, what was tried yesterday is what Herbert Hoover actually did in 1931. He set up a separate corporation or government agency that bailed out the banks and the bankers. And they got their paychecks and they got their bonuses and they got enough money to keep them going through the election of 32. Didn't help a whole lot. And the banks by late 32, early 33, all failed anyway. And what Roosevelt had to do was a cold reboot. I've got an article about this up on both in our blog at airamerica.com and on tomhartman.com, just laying this out. And we need to do the same thing Franklin Roosevelt did. He rebooted democracy. He said anybody who has a mortgage, because most of the mortgages back then were five-year mortgages with a balloon payment at the end, and you know, which didn't work particularly well. He said anybody who has a mortgage, we will buy it from you and give you a 30-year mortgage at a 3% interest rate.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-303-2270.
It's not for you.
Well, if you go over to Congressman Peter DeFazio's website, DeFazio, DeFazio.house.gov, the national debt today, $9,881,513,037,000. It's going so fast I can't count them. Your share of the national debt, $32,938. That includes babies. Congressman Peter DeFazio, we should call this the birth tax.
Yeah, or your inheritance at birth, which is a huge pile of debt, and they want to increase that instantaneously by $700 billion to buy a bunch of bad debts or bets or whatever you want to call them from Wall Street.
Right. We're talking with Congressman Peter DeFazio of Oregon, and Congressman, you have put forward an alternative proposal to the one that got shot down yesterday. Tell us about it.
Well, that's correct. I think the policy and premise is wrong that, you know, borrowing or printing $700 billion and buying up so-called illiquid assets from Wall Street, is somehow going to free up capital flows among banks. What we understand is that, there is a problem with among banks. You could deal with it more directly through regulation, suspend something called the mark-to-market rule, which makes them say their assets are worthless. Mr. Isaacs headed the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation during the savings and loan crisis. He says actually they're performing 75% of the time, but they have to value them at zero. That means they can't lend anybody money because they're essentially underwater or illiquid. So just an accounting change could begin to free up money. Throwing money at the top on Wall Street and hoping somehow it'll solve this problem and somehow it'll trickle down and not get at the basic problem underlying it in housing and in the real economy is a really bad idea. So we're proposing regulatory changes that the Bush administration could make. We're going to introduce legislation to make them make those changes because I think actually they're kind of precipitating in part some of this crisis, making it worse because they really want the $700 billion for Wall Street.
Yeah, and let's keep in mind, most of these institutions that are going to be bailed out are not institutions that are at risk of failing.
That's correct. And, you know, there's an interesting one very smart member of Congress said to me yesterday. He said, I finally got it. He said, this is all about Paulson because Paulson bought AIG, right? If you read the New York Times last
right.
Sunday,
if AIG went down.
Fabulous company, 106,000 employees. All its lines of business except for one are very profitable, and that one was run by 47 guys in the London office who, you know, who sold insurance they thought they'd never have to pay on, and that's what put them at risk. Well, guess what now? If Paulson doesn't somehow get a hold of those securities or make them more valuable, those people who have the insurance are going to come to AIG. They're going to ask to be paid. It's over $1 trillion of insurance. And who owns AIG? Hank Paulson.
Right. Well, it's not Hank Paulson.
Well,
it's
I mean, you know, who bought it? Hank Paulson. Who owns it? We do.
Yeah, yeah. and in fact, my understanding is that the biggest company that actually could go down if AIG went down was Goldman Sachs.
Which and they were in the room while the deal was cut, but they were there to give impartial general advice.
Yeah. So Congressman Peter DeFazio, DeFazio.house.gov is the website, DeFazio. You suggested that we should reimpose this STET tax, this securities transfer excise tax of 0.25% on the exchange of stock or other securities.
Right. If you are going to place the Paulson bet, that is, if you're going to allow him to borrow $700 billion or print it in the name of the taxpayer, then since, you know, I don't think the taxpayer should be on the hook. So if he's going to place that bet, which many say is a risky strategy, if we imposed this very modest tax, half of what they charge on the London Exchange, by the way, it would raise $150 billion a year. That means you can pay off Hank's bet in 5 years if he loses all the money or six.
Right. And plus, actually, you know, Dean Baker proposed this a couple of years ago as a way to pay for a national health insurance program.
You could pay for a lot of stuff with $150 billion a year.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's really
health insurance, you know, double our spending on crumbling infrastructure for a fraction of that. I mean, yeah.
Right.
No.
Yeah. So, Congressman DeFazio, if
You got to know the street doesn't like it. I was getting traction with this in the Democratic caucus leadership. I presented it in the caucus. I just, a couple of them said, oh, good idea. Go to the Blue Dog Conservative Democrats. Great idea. I'm getting traction on one day. I think it was Monday or Tuesday. Mm-hmm. And then the next day,
shows up on Capitol Hill, Laura Tyson, the economic advisor to Bill Clinton. And she thinks it's horrible. The street will hate it, and it'll cause the markets to tremble and crumble. And she does happen to be on the board of directors, Morgan Stanley. She was allowed to address the caucus, So anyway.
This is talk about failures of leadership within the caucus, frankly. What do you think we should do?
We're having a press conference at 3 to propose a number. I'm dividing the problem in half. There are things you need to do to address this liquidity or capital or, you know, money issue among.
It's really the credit problem.
Right, among big banks. And make sure it doesn't filter down to the little banks and credit unions where it hasn't hit yet.
Right.
And we're going to propose 5 regulatory changes that we believe, according to Mr. Isaacs, could resolve that issue. And then the other half is, as Democrats, we should be talking about, and none of this is in the Paulson bill, going at the roots of the problem. That is the declining housing market, the foreclosures, the lack of opportunity and jobs and investment out there. That's what Democrats should be talking about. FDR rebuilt the economy. How? From the bottom up. He put people to work. He built things of value, enduring value, like the Bonneville Power Administration, the Pacific Northwest, the TVA. Those were FDR investments that are still paying dividends, and Paulson just wants to borrow the money and throw it on the top at Wall Street.
Exactly the same thing Herbert Hoover did in 1931, by the way.
Really? Okay.
Yeah. The I want to call it the Resolution Trust. I don't have it in front of me. It's not called that. But the agency that FDR rebooted in 1933 was actually started in 1931 by Hoover,
mm-hmm.
and it was used to bail out the banks.
Really? Okay. I gotta get that. Thank you.
Yeah. Track that one down.
Yeah.
Find it. So break the thing into. Yeah. It makes perfect sense. I mean, I was mentioning to our listeners earlier. I'm on the board of a charity in New Hampshire, a community for abused kids, the Salem Children's Village, which my wife and I actually started 30 years ago. It's paid by the state. I mean, you're caring for kids who are wards of the state, and very often the state is late in their payments, and so we've got a line of credit to help make payroll. And the bank just said, sorry, we don't have money for the line of credit. So
mm-hmm.
we've got 4 weeks of payroll in the bank, and then we close the doors. And if we can't do some quick fundraising, which is, you know, what I'm encouraging people to go to SalemChildrensVillage.org, and if they want to make a donation, tax-deductible donation to a 501c3. But
why did the bank have to do that?
Well, what I'm hearing is that this is not a unique story around the
right.
country, that a lot of, you know, that the interbank lending rate has gotten so high that small regional banks can't get money to lend, you know.
But why can't they go to the Fed window?
I don't know.
See, I think there may be, again, something. I had the credit unions in last week. They said, we're open for business, we're lending, but the funny thing is we're getting new customers. People with perfectly sound businesses are getting their lines of credit cut off at banks, and the banks are telling them that's at the direction of the FDIC. So you wonder if they're trying to manufacture a Main Street crisis, because they keep talking about the Main Street crisis, which most
right.
people aren't feeling, in order to stampede people to take care of the Wall Street crisis.
Although in June, the New York Times ran an article, I was just sharing it with my listeners a few
mm-hmm.
minutes ago, that American Express is cutting back by 10% the amount of credit that they're offering on their credit cards, that the credit card companies were preparing and in many cases executing a plan to recalibrate how much credit that they would offer. Now that might just be prudent.
Oh, but guess what? Hank Paulson's plan includes buying credit card debt.
Oh man.
You didn't know that?
No.
He put it in explicitly in his second draft, credit cards, student loans, and auto loans. I raised that issue with the caucus. I was told it would come out. It did come out, but then the final bill says Hank Paulson may, he's specifically authorized to buy mortgage-backed securities, and he may buy any other security he deems necessary. Any other.
What do you think about Bernie Sanders' 10% surtax on people with incomes, families with incomes over $1 million? It seems to me like, you know, it would never get through Congress, but it's a great idea.
That's a great idea. I propose the idea of a 1% tax on wealth over $5 million. That raises more than enough money to take care of this problem. There are ways to better target the people who benefited from this. But I just thought this, you know, this non-controversial security transfer fee that we had in place, starting in World War One, through the boom of the 20s, through the Great Depression where it was doubled, through World War II, through the big boom in the 50s into the 60s, didn't hurt the stock market then, and that would pay for it. I figured that would be non-controversial, but I find out the street wouldn't like it.
Yeah, but, you know, of course the street wouldn't like it. But it also...
But they got their hand out. It's kind of like,
yeah.
You get your hand out and you won't accept a 0.25% transaction fee.
Well, they're all playing Cleavon Little from Blazing Saddles, you know, with a gun to his, with his own gun in his own hand to his own head saying,
right.
You know, get any closer and I'll shoot the black guy. I mean, you know, it's that's what's going on. I mean, isn't it?
Yeah. Oh, no, no. They're trying to hold us hostage. I saw one interview yesterday after our vote, some guy saying they think they can mess with Wall Street. We'll show them. And, you know, the market was going down. So, I mean, you know, there was some
right.
of that attitude among the
now,
masters of the universe.
The market's back. We have about a minute here, Congressman. The market's back up right now. And,
yeah.
and you know, people saying, well, okay, the financial part of the market, you know, financial sector is a chunk of the market, but it's not the entire market. They're
nope.
still making pharmaceuticals. They're still running hospitals.
Right.
They're still, you know, selling shoes. They're still, you know, fill in the blank.
Yep.
And so basically what the market did yesterday in wiping out $1 trillion worth of wealth was wiped out the BS that was in the financial services sector. And now it's just going to continue on. Do you think that this is a non-crisis?
There are a lot of economists, a lot of people smarter than me who question the depth and breadth of this so-called crisis. And for Bush and Paulson to continue, I mean, the Secretary of the Treasury talking down, you know, the economy. That
but he looked panicked yesterday. Do you see that press conference? I mean, he looked like a man in panic.
Yeah, well, guess what? A lot of his best friends, people he has worked with and drunk with and played with his whole life, are going from billionaires to multimillionaires. It's very upsetting to him.
That makes, yeah, you're absolutely right. That's got to be it. No, I'm right there with you. Congressman Peter DeFazio, you can read all about it at defazio.house.gov. And, Congressman, you're doing such great work for the state of Oregon. Thanks so much, and keep it up.
Thank you, Tom.
Good talking with you. 46 minutes past the hour.
Watch live video of the Tom Hartman Program at hartmanradio.com.
Support abortion or being gay. It's not her fault, just the Republican way.
Sarah, 9.5 minutes Sarah, before the hour. Just a quick heads up, on Friday of this week, we'll be doing our show from our affiliate in Palm Springs. And I'll be speaking at a conference in Palm Springs, The Evolution of Revolution, Shining Dawn's Early Light on Spirit, Science, and the System. Is the title of the conference at the Renaissance Esmeralda Resort and Spa in actually in Indian Wells, California, which is just down the road from Palm Springs. And MoveOn.org is asking for an apology from Tom Brokaw for using phony numbers. This was this weekend on Sunday afternoon, right after Steve Schmidt kept talking over David Axelrod continuously. Tom Brokaw wrapped this thing up like this.
More of the same, Steve.
In fairness to everybody here, I'm just going to end on one note, and that is that we continue to poll on who's best equipped to be commander-in-chief. John McCain continues to lead in that category, despite the criticism from Barack Obama, by a factor of 53% to 42% in our latest NBC News Wall Street Journal poll. Gentlemen, thank you very much. I wish we could spend the rest of the day talking about these issues.
And you look at David Axelrod, and he's like, yeah, I just got whacked upside the head. Turns out that number was from the day after the Republican National Convention. And Tom Brokaw was, at the very least, being very disingenuous. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. MoveOn.org is demanding an apology from Tom Brokaw.
I saw that.
You know, do you think they'll get it?
No.
Okay. I suspect you're right.
That's a fast answer.
Yeah, I suspect you're right. So what's going on in Washington, D.C., Ellen?
Well, there's actually quite a bit. Today, Senator Minority Leader McConnell, the Senate is still meeting despite the Jewish holiday, and they said we're going to get this done this week and convince the American people that Congress can rise to the occasion. And then they also had Majority Leader Reid say that he's hopeful and confident on all sides, House and Senate. There are all kinds of ideas. One of them is to have essentially a Senate bill that then would attach to another bill and then get it to the House. Also, today they are trying to get the FDIC to raise the guarantee from $100,000 to $250,000 for each account. You and I have talked about that a number of times.
Yeah.
The White House today, Tony Fredo talked about the frozen market, and he said that this is necessary to get the market restarted. He said there's no single bullet. He also said that there was not a need to start over, that they need a solution that will begin to fix the problem. Senator McCain and Obama both spoke to the president today. And he also talked about that he essentially was talking about the bailout as sort of shorthand for something that was much more complex. So they're now saying, you know, the word bailout is not necessarily the right word to use here.
Hmm. Interesting. Yeah. Well, this is, I mean, on Fox News back, I think it was Thursday, one of their commentators or one of the people who was on there, it was over at thinkprogress.org. In fact, we played it on the air. I don't recall which one of the right wingers it was who came out with it. He said, we got to stop calling this thing a bailout and start calling it a rescue. The American people will go along with a rescue. They don't like bailouts. And within hours, all across the corporate media in America, they started calling it a rescue.
Well, what can I say? Television had an amazing impact.
Yeah. Sort of right-wing talking points.
That actually was in the papers this morning, but bears mentioning again, because this happened yesterday, that and it sort of gotten lost in a lot of this. I'm sure you've been talking about it, but that the federal grand jury in New York investigating accounting disclosure and corporate governance issues at Freddie and Fannie. And I think that that's important to note, that it is now going to grand jury.
Yeah, they're seriously looking at this. Yeah, no, I haven't mentioned it, and thank you for doing so. That is an important one. And also, you know, going to the grand jury, or at least going to a special prosecutor, Alberto Gonzalez?
Apparently, that actually is a go-ahead from the Justice Department, as I understand it.
Yeah, so do you think that they're starting to get clean, or do you figure that it's just inevitable, they might as well do it, and Bush will pardon anyway? So
I'm outside here in Washington, and there's a big fire truck all the time. But I don't know whether this is sort of a preemptive strike to get the press off their back. I can't really tell on that one. Also, House Foreign Affairs Committee, Howard Berman, said today that they are thinking about looking at a GAO, that's Government Accountability Office, to take a look at what U.S. Exports are going directly to Iran. Today is the day that voting starts in Ohio.
Oh, interesting. Interesting. And so early voting.
That's right. Early voting. And because obviously today, if there's a lot of voting this week, it certainly will move Ohio in a particular direction.
Does that mean that in Ohio today that you can mail in an early voting ballot, or does it mean you can actually show up?
It means you can go and vote, and I should know the answer to that since I'm from Ohio. Or whether that means you mail in a ballot, I don't know. I think that you may be able to actually go there and vote.
It would be interesting to find out.
I will find that out immediately.
Thank you. Thank you. Ellen Ratner, TalkReadyNews.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Much of this disaster is actually being manufactured in the White House so that the big Wall Street firms are not going to lose their golden parachutes and you know, it's just to benefit a very few, relatively small number of very large financial services corporations. And what a great October surprise. We'll see. We'll see how it shakes out. But Robert Baer is with us. He's back with us. He's the author of a number of books, Sleeping with the Devil, about the Saudi royal family. We had him on and talked about that. See No Evil, which recounts his years as a CIA operative, and was based on the movie Syriana was based on it, which earned George Clooney his Oscar. He has a new book out, The Devil We Know, Dealing with the New Iranian Superpower. Robert, welcome to the program.
Thanks. It's great to be back.
What is it about Iran that we don't know that we know, if you know what I mean?
Here's what we know, and I think if you read the press carefully, it's very clear, but most people don't, and TV certainly doesn't get it. The Iranians are expanding by proxy. Hezbollah, as we know, is an Iranian creation. It's a guerrilla army, the best in the, you know, maybe in the 20th century.
Mm-hmm.
And they're doing the same in Iraq.
Hezbollah largely in Lebanon.
Yeah, and Hezbollah has also moved into Iraq, as well as other groups under Iranian control. Last week, the ambassador, our ambassador to Baghdad, said very clearly that the Iranians were blocking an agreement, a status of forces agreement with Iraq. That's a big statement. That thanks to the financial crisis, we missed it. So basically, the Iranians are saying, hey, Americans, get out of Iraq. It's ours. That's a bit of an exaggeration, but it's not too much for them.
Well, the reality, the geopolitical reality for the better part of 40 years was that Iraq was the buffer between the largely Shia-dominated Middle East and the Shia superpower of Iran.
It was in 2 short weeks, we destroyed the shield of the Arabs.
That's
in
right.
other words, at the end of the day, this is going to be an Iranian victory rather than an American victory.
Well, and that was fairly easily predicted from day one, was it not, when we first decided to invade Iraq?
It's very predictable, and once we decided to put in a democracy rather than another dictatorship, we said to the Iranians, hey, it's yours.
Right, but how do you put in a democracy in a country without a functioning sewer system?
You can't. It was never a chance of having a real democracy, anything like ours. Nothing.
Right.
It was impossible. It was always impossible. It was a nice idea, pretty idea, but it was always impossible.
Yeah, there has to be some, you know, baseline. You have to meet the bottom of Maslow's hierarchy of human needs. You have to meet safety, security, and homeostasis. You know, people have to have food, and they need to be able to sleep, you know, peacefully at night, knowing that things are going to be fine the next day. And water, septic, electric, things like that. We took all that out. So
there wasn't a chance. I mean, what we did was we empowered a bunch of militias that are beholden to Iran.
Sure. What are the chances, Robert Baer, that – well, let me flip this back around. It seems to me, and I don't pretend to have your knowledge or experience in the region, although I have been in – I've not been in Iran, but I've certainly been in the Middle East many, many times over the years. And it seems to me that one of the reasons why Hezbollah has had the success it has had in some of the areas in southern Lebanon – and for that matter, Hamas had success in Gaza, is that they're providing social services. They're building schools. They're building hospitals. They're paying old age pensions. They're making sure people have oil. They're basically taking care of the things that the government is failing to take care of in some regards.
Well, look at the southern suburbs of Beirut. That was all Shia. It was bombed in the 2006 war.
Mm-hmm.
The Iranians, last time I was there, built it back within basically a year.
Yeah, and so my question is, you know, setting using that as the setup, basically, my question is, instead of spending $1 trillion on weaponry in the Middle East, which we've done now, what if we had spent 1/10 of that or even 1/100 of that helping build schools and mosques and hospitals and, infrastructure in all those countries in the region, helping them raise themselves up to that threshold in Maslow's hierarchy above which a democracy can exist, and thus isolate Iran, or for that matter, go into, you know, to the extent that it's possible, go into Iran and essentially, I don't want to say love them to death or something sappy like that, but, you know, essentially, I'll leave it at that.
Here's the problem, and this isn't intentional on anybody's part. It was the easy way to do things. We went into Saudi Arabia. We bought their oil. we gave them trillions and trillions of dollars in oil revenues. But rather than having that money go into society and building, you know, houses and roads and medical for the common people, it's gone into the pockets of the princes,
right,
who are living in estates the size of Disneyland.
Right. Although the keep in mind, there's 10,000 princes there, aren't there? I mean, there is a fair amount of trickle down.
There's closer to 15, and they're all paying. There is a trickle down effect, but the trickle down economics in Saudi Arabia hasn't worked.
Right.
On the
worked anywhere.
Yeah, it hasn't worked anywhere. Yeah, exactly. But the Iranians went into Lebanon and said, all right, one, we're going to build a real military that's going to beat the Israelis, and they did beat them in 2006 in that 34-day war. And two is we're going to be incorruptible, and they have been incorruptible. And three is we're going to put poor money into the poor people. That kind of message is undercutting any hope we have.
Right. Well, so why don't we take that message and do the exact same thing?
I don't know. Why didn't we fix the subprime market before it collapsed? Same deal, inertia.
Well, I'd say ideology.
It is ideology, and it's a Washington-based ideology of, if you know, you get a bigger hammer and you hit it harder each time.
Right.
And it's not working. And this is what I'm trying to tell people. My book is these guys, through proxies, through a foreign aid program, through sheer rational calculations of power, they've beat us.
Now, at the same time, we have Russia, and here we had Saakashvili. You know, he starts bombing South Ossetia, and the next day the Russians move in, and that story has been very weirdly characterized in the American media, and perhaps even more weirdly characterized in the Russian media. But the bottom line, that conflict creating some rifts with the United States. Certainly, if McCain is elected president, we'll have a serious problem with Russia.
Oh, it'd be incredible, because what the Russians are going to do, and they've done it already, turn around and they're going to arm Venezuela and
Iran.
Yeah, so, I mean, we're just, you know, going to say, what they're saying is basically, you go into our southern tier, and we'll go into yours.
Yeah, which is actually not all that unreasonable. I mean, keep in mind, during the Cuban Missile Crisis, Kennedy said, no, you can't put missiles in, you know, 90 miles off our coast. And Khrushchev said, well, you can't have missiles in Turkey then, because that's 90 miles off our coast, functionally, or the functional equivalent. And we pulled our missiles out of Turkey 6 months later.
I know, it was a fair agreement. We, you know, we should go back to the Cold War rules. I don't see why we should be messing around in Georgia myself. I mean, I used to be, when I was in the CIA, head of the Caucasus and Central Asia, and Georgia falls under the Caucasus. And, you know, they're delightful people and all that, but do we really want to go back into the Cold War?
Well, and over
financial meltdown?
Yeah, and over Saakashvili, a guy who put his political opponents in prison, who shut down the press, who seized a television station, oddly enough owned by Rupert Murdoch, you know, who rigged broad consensus that he rigged the elections.
But they're not Democrats, and it's pretty much a narco-smuggling state as well, too. I mean, these aren't the guys you want to go to bat for.
Right, but they've got a big oil pipeline going through there, so Cheney and Bush are gung-ho for them.
Yeah, they got the oil pipeline, and then you've also got McCain's advisors are working for Georgia
right,
on a personal basis.
Yeah, Randy Shuneman, yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, this is not a good situation.
So
we do not need another war in the Middle East or in the Caucasus.
So Robert Baer, your new book, The Devil We Know, we have less than a minute left. What do we...
Go cut a deal with Tehran, and we can do it. Look, they were a terror. Here's the problem in this country. They were a terrorist state from 1979 to 1996. It's a long time. They have American blood on their hands, but they have stopped that.
They came to Bob Ney through the Swiss and said, we're willing to recognize Israel and stop all nuclear development.
They absolutely,
and he gave that to the Bush administration, and they put him in prison.
They'll do both. They will stop nuclear development, but we have to give them something.
Sure.
And there's going to be a price. We have to pay the price. But what we don't want to do is sacrifice Israel for a neocon belief that we can conquer and control the Middle East. It's stupid.
Right. Yeah, and that seems to be the road that certainly the McCain camp is going down, the whole neocon camp.
No can do.
Right. Robert Baer, brilliant, brilliant. The Devil We Know. I'm looking forward to reading this book. Thank you so much for being on the program.
Thanks, Tom.
Good talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. We'll be right back with your calls, 866-303-2270.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. We'll be right back.
There's a whole lot more like me. How about you? I punch the clock trying to make it to the top. How about you? I ain't got no blue blood trust fund I can dip into. Yeah, I wish Uncle Sam would give a damn about the man whose collar's blue.
But if 21 minutes past the hour, well, it's pretty amazing here. The polls, there are some polls that are indicating that John McCain's down to 40% support, Barack Obama above 52%. AP reported Republican John McCain has maneuvered himself into a political dead end by his 5 weeks to find his way out. Now, you know, let's keep in mind that I don't recall how many weeks out it was. I think it was seven. It might have been six or thereabouts. Dukakis was way ahead of George Herbert Walker Bush. I think it was 17 points. Folks in our chat room, I'm sure, can track that down and get the details. And then they pulled out of their hat the whole Willie Horton ad thing and, boom, blew him up. So I would not say that this thing is in the bag and I would not be celebrating, but it sure is looking bad for John McCain. Sure is looking bad for John McCain. And this financial crisis, whether it was created now by the administration in an attempt to help the Republicans or whether it was created now by the administration in an attempt to simply have the rich bail out the rich, basically. I mean, is this the Bushies taking the silver and the China with them when they leave the White House? Sure looks like it. Or was it a disaster that was supposed to happen on November 5th, the day after the election, particularly if a Democrat was elected? But even if the Democrats just continue to hold the House and the Senate, and so then the Republicans could say, see, this is what happens when a Democrat gets elected. And then they get to take the China and the silver with them when they leave, because there's still another congressional session before the new president is sworn in on January 21st, as I recall. Which is it? I don't know. Ralph in Northampton, Massachusetts, listening on WRSI. Hey, Ralph, what's up? Ralph, you are on the air. And he's not there. Devron in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Devron, what's on your mind today?
Hello, Tom. Two quick points. Earlier, when you started the program, you said it's the case of the downward up. And I was thinking this is more like Reaganomics, the trickle down theory coming home to roost. I mean, how are we
from exactly
the bottom?
What it is.
You know, and then my main point when I called with your, excuse me, with your screener, Tom, great show, love what you do. What I was going to say is, how similar is this to what was going on in the 80s in Mexico? I grew up in San Diego, and we just really took advantage of going down there, and, you know, everything was cheap. The people were, well, everybody knows what.
When the peso got devalued, yeah.
Yeah, 6,000 was it, or up to, you know, I mean, it just got, it just was crazy.
Yeah.
And the infrastructure was total down there. There was a lot of, I think, I look at Mexico, and I think they try to take bits of what America does and make it work, but a lot of their infrastructure is just ruined. You see buildings and edifices that were started, not completed. I don't know.
Well, yeah, and let's keep in mind, Mexico, the poverty has actually increased in Mexico since NAFTA, and there's one guy, Carlos Slim, who owns one-third of all the wealth in the Mexican stock market. One-third.
Right.
And
didn't the government sell them their telephones?
Yeah, that's how he made his fortune, was with the telephone monopoly, and then now he's the biggest provider of cell phones, and now he's in manufacturing, and he's in retailing, and he's in restaurants, and he's in steel.
And mind you, Mexico had the worst telephone system in the 80s. I don't know how good it is now, but it was horrible. And all the money they used to charge people to call there. I mean, it makes sense now. Thanks a lot, Tom.
Yeah.
One love.
You're welcome. Thanks a lot for the call, Devron. Tim in Los Angeles. Hey, Tim, what's up?
Jim in Los Angeles.
Yeah, that's you, Tim.
Yeah, no, I'm Jim.
Oh, Jim, I'm sorry. You're on
hey,
the air.
Hey, look, I'm a classmate of Johnny McCain's, and I went to our 50th reunion last week.
You talking about the Naval
Academy?
I
got to report on it.
Okay.
Well, okay. Well, what I was doing was an anti-torture demonstration, and I was not at all popular in Annapolis. I'll tell you, I drove all over the East Coast, from New Hampshire to Maryland, and the only place I ever saw any McCain signs was Annapolis. Hmm. And these people are just ridiculously for McCain. Hmm. Now, I knew him. I was a friend of his. But the whole thing I was on was torture. And I interviewed the guy who was in charge of the ethics department at the Naval Academy. And do you know what the main definition is of being responsible for torture?
No.
Well, I asked him, well, how about waterboarding? And he said, well, if the guy who is doing it is not intending to kill somebody, to kill his interrogator, then it's not torture. In other words, it's whatever in the mind.
Well, this is what John Yoo was writing, and this is what Rumsfeld was saying. If it's not if it doesn't constitute organ failure or death, it's not torture. That's incredible. Jim, thanks for the report, and good on you for going to Annapolis as an anti-torture advocate. Congratulations. Well done. 27 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. We'll be back with more of your calls and the news of the day on the Tom Hartman Program, fighting for the common man and the common good.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-303-2270.
Minutes past the hour. Uh-oh, the pigeons are out there. Pigeon alert. Robins and dunnocks have been usurped in the garden by wood pigeons, which are now only outnumbered in Britain's gardens by blackbirds and blue tits. This wood pigeons with an estimated three... Now, is it any coincidence? Wood pigeons didn't even make the top 10 of garden birds back in 1995, and now they're number 3. They've been exploding in numbers in Great Britain. And I don't know how closely related they are to the kind of pigeons that we have here, but are they robots too? Keep in mind, in the UK, it is the ultimate surveillance society. More people are under surveillance per capita on a more continuous basis in England than anywhere in the world. Are the pigeons playing a role? Kathy in Detroit, Michigan, listening on WDTW. Hey, Kathy, what's up?
Hi, Tom. This is the time I've gotten through to you, but I want to, first of all, thank you for all the information that that I've gathered from listening to your program for many, many months now. Educational, political information. But I did want to comment as to why no one has suggested that the CEOs and executives that have brought these companies to bankruptcy are not forced to reimburse their some of their multi-million dollar salaries and bonuses.
If you rob a bank and you make off with $1 million and you deposit it in another bank and they convict you and send you to jail, you have to pay back that $1 million too. You have to get back the money you stole. That's a very good question, Kathy, and it's one that, in fact, highlights the absurdity of the provisions in this bill. All they did was they said that a corporation, instead of being able to deduct the first $1 million of a CEO's pay, can only deduct from their taxes the first $500,000 of the CEO's pay. Doesn't mean they couldn't pay them $1 million. It just means it's not tax deductible anymore. So it's slightly more expensive to the corporation. And it's just wrong. It's just so wrong. This whole bailout, this whole trickle down from the top down strategy is wrong. The problem is, and Kathy, thank you for the call. The problem is that these guys try to do it down the middle. Right? They tried to satisfy the right-wing ideology of trickle-down economics, do it from the top down. And they tried to satisfy I'm reluctant to call it left-wing even, but they tried to throw a bone basically to the average American saying, oh yeah, and we're gonna make sure that the government gets some of this money back and that the big shots don't get the big salaries. And what they succeeded in doing was upsetting everybody. The Democrats in Congress should, and the problem, of course, is I think the Blue Dog Caucus, although Peter DeFazio said that they were all in favor of the Stets until they heard from, that Wall Street wouldn't like it. But if we had enough liberals in the House of Representatives and in the Senate to say, okay, we're going to redo the New Deal. It worked real well, thank you very much, and it worked for the better part of 50 years. In fact, the fragments of the New Deal are the thing that's holding everything together right now. Scott in Virginia Beach. Hey, Scott, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I know nothing about economics. I'm kind of like David Stockman. I realize I don't know what the heck's going on when it gets to something like this. But I got an instinct that we're in big trouble. We're better off with this bill than without it. And the reason is, if you're right, what you're telling us is all these Democrats that voted for this bill, most of them are liberals. Most of them are in safe seats. So what you're telling us is these guys are a bunch of Wall Street lackeys. And the same goes for Obama. Why is he supporting this bill when it would be politically better for him to be against it?
I think that what the bill will do is, well, first of all, that's a good question, Scott. And I think frankly that he's going to be harmed by supporting, had the bill passed, he would have been politically harmed by that. And there are people who are suggesting that was the plan. The plan was to put the Democrats in a box and force them to vote against the will of the American people. The vast majority of Americans are opposed to this legislation. As Peter DeFazio said, there's a lot of other ways to accomplish exactly what this bill accomplishes. Nobody's disagreeing. I'm not disagreeing. I mean, the reason why I'm trying to encourage people to go to SalemChildrensVillage.org and make a donation is because, the credit markets are freezing up. The easy money is not out there anymore. And there are, all kinds of businesses and charities and individuals are going to get hit by this.
Well, the reason that's not right, Tom, is because all these Democrats that voted for it are in safe seats. They got no reason to vote for this bill.
Well, I haven't done a survey of all the Democrats, Scott, but I can tell you from what I was reading yesterday of the Republicans, and you can find this over at thinkprogress.org, the Republicans who voted for this on average took about $200,000 to $250,000 in campaign contributions from the financial services industry. The Republicans who voted against it had in the neighborhood of $100,000. It was almost 2-1.
Well, I don't care about Republicans. I'm a Democrat. And if you're right, these guys are all in safe seats. And the only reason for them to vote for it is if they believed in it or if they're Wall Street lackeys, too. And if that's the case, what's the point of going and voting?
Well, the point of going to voting is to get people in who are not Wall Street lackeys, which I think would be a fine thing to do.
Well, there's no choice. I mean, if these guys...
Well, actually, it goes right across the board. This, what I said about Republicans was not true. It's Republicans and Democrats. Here, I'll read you the thing. This is from maplight.org. You can find it over at thinkprogress.org. Over the past 5 years, banks and security firms gave an average of $231,877 in political contributions to each representative, that would be Democrat or Republican, voting in favor of the bailout, compared with an average of only $150,982 to each representative voting against the bailout. 54% more money given to those who voted yes. So, I think that, the power of lobbying in Washington, D.C. cannot be discounted. It's another example of how broken the system is, Scott. And it's why we need to get people in who are willing to say no, who are just absolutely willing to say no, no to the lobbyists. And, but do we need something to be done? Yeah, we need a lot to be done. Our country's falling apart. We don't make things anymore. We don't have value here. The reason why I think that this Great Depression that I believe that we are on the edge of sliding into, although I think it's going to take a year or so to get there, is arguably going to be worse than the one of the 1930s, is because in the 1930s we made things. We had the ability. Remember World War I started and we suddenly were making all these tanks and airplanes. And we had manufacturing capacity in this country. We can't make a cruise missile right now without a chip from China. We can't make a destroyer or a battleship without parts from the only country in the last 10 years that has actually threatened to nuke us. Now tell me that makes sense. I mean, you can't, obviously. So, anyway. I'm off on a rant. Vern in Phoenix, Arizona. Hey, Vern.
Hey, good morning, Tom. I wanted to speak about an earlier conversation in the show about the union activities.
About the Employee Free Choice Act.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with the legislation, but I am familiar with the process, at least as it was a number of years ago. I went through it twice.
Mm-hmm.
And basically how it functioned was some employees talked with the union and expressed an interest. Once an interest was expressed, the union would facilitate people petitioning the National Labor Relations Board. What happened, they would hand out cards, and anybody who was interested would sign a card saying that they were interested in being represented by this union. Once the Labor Relations Board received enough petitions, you know, based on how many total employees there were.
Right, it's a 30% threshold right now.
Okay. Then the NLRB would come in and set up an election.
Right. Now the one thing that you've left out of this dialogue, Vern, is that the union actually can't come into the workplace. The workplace can keep the union out. And, in fact, they can fire people for organizing activity while they're on the job. Whereas the company, and this is a $2 billion a year industry right now in the United States, the companies typically bring in consultants who do PowerPoint presentations and slideshows and show movies about the horrors of a union, and the company can threaten to destroy, to blow people's jobs up if they join the union.
Right, exactly, and they use those indications anyway. Anyway, the thing is that when you're doing the organizing part, this is before the government's involved. This is when you actually they're more vulnerable to nefarious acts by the company.
Right.
Basically, what happens is, anybody who's interested in the union and who's probably going to vote yes on representation are the people that's sending these cards to get the vote. The people who do not want the union, it's like anything else. You don't want something, you stop the election before it even gets started.
Right.
So I don't know what this legislation is, but my opinion is that if the names of anybody who sent in cards is exposed, or the names of anybody who voted for union representation in the vote are exposed, that's a bad thing.
Well, it's a bad thing except for the fact that in the vast majority of workplaces in the United States, people actually want a union. So those are available, by the way, right now under the petition with the NLRB, you know, because the government has to be transparent. So, you know, bottom line, either way, People know that you're working on behalf of the union, but what this says is very simply that the company cannot. It strengthens the laws that prevent the company that allow the company to fire. It makes it harder for companies to fire people for organizing activity, and it allows people to not have to go through the whole huge long song and dance where the company does all their presentations and everything, and the union basically can't do anything at all in the workplace, and then the NLRB supervises a vote that's actually held in the workplace, if you don't think that's intimidating. So, you know, Vern, either way, you're going to be outed. But, you know, let's just make it simple and let people have a union. I mean, it's pretty straightforward, I think. 45 minutes past the hour, 866-303-2270. We're going to have an advertiser of the week here, theinevitableyou.com, right after this break. And then we'll get back to your calls. Stick around.
Watch live video of the Tom Hartman Program at HartmanRadio.com.
Your motives are wrong and your bombs are not smart, or I wouldn't see children with lives torn apart. If a fox hid himself under my chicken's nest, Lord, you'd blow the whole farm up and you'd call it success. But you open my eyes, 'cause it's time to say no to the military industry running this show. And it's time for the greedy on Capitol Hill to send their own sons and daughters to die for their will. Not Buddha, not Allah, not God sets us free. Not the person up front saying, listen to me. I won't give up my rights to a mere pack of thieves, wearing suits and big smiles with a trick up each sleeve. 'Cause it's our right to know all that they do, and they don't do a thing unless we tell them to. 'Cause they represent us, not those big wigs uptown. They wanna fight about that, then I'll go a few rounds. I'll stand and let my voice be heard. I'll stand and let my voice be heard. I'll stand up, speak out. This is still my country. I'll stand and let my voice ring free.
Nine minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. Every week we have one of our advertisers on our local stations on to tell us about how things are going. How does it work for advertising on Progressive Talk Radio? And give them a minute to tell us all about their product or service, and give them a minute to tell us about what their experience has been advertising, to hopefully encourage other companies who, you know, owners of small businesses or large business, whatever, who may be listening right now to say, you know, hey, this could be a good advertising medium. I'm looking at a website, Design Your Life Consciously to Create All You Deserve. Many do not realize how quickly and permanently we can change and transform our reality when we are aware. Embrace the inevitable you and take the next step now. TheInevitableYou.com is the website. Bill Sumner is the business coach. Bill, welcome to the show.
Hey, good morning, Tom. Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. You've been advertising on AM 760, Colorado's Progressive Talk. And first of all, tell us about your product.
I am a business coach or a life coach. What I do is help people truly realize their potential. There are motivational tools out there like The Secret or books, but in general, most people run into a challenge or a problem trying to implement a movie like The Secret because they have neural patterns or programs that they're running in their mind and in their reality that is in fact in conflict. And what they will do is they'll record, hey, I'm the problem or there's something wrong with me. They will understand that humans have a lot of potential, but they will view other people have potential and they'll go, hey, look at me, I'm working hard, I'm doing the best I can, but maybe I don't deserve so much, and they will diminish and downgrade themselves. And it's not about them, it's about the programs they're running, it's the recipes of life.
So you're teaching people how to basically reprogram their own brains.
Exactly.
Yeah, very, very good. And tell us your experience. The website, by the way, The Inevitable You, and we're talking with Bill Sumner, who is a life coach, a business coach. Bill, tell us about your experience advertising on AM 760 Colorado's Progressive Talk.
Oh, KKZN has been a great channel. You know, I was on Sister Channel for a while, and the quality of calls in this network, the people that you're going to meet, the people that you talk to, the people that call in and ask questions during my show, they're a high demographic, they're a talented bunch of people. They really care, I think, at a deeper level about this planet and about the world and about how things are going on. And they're just a great bunch of people. I have been thrilled since I've moved over to AM 760. It's been a very powerful move for me and my business.
That's great. That's great. Bill, thanks so much for sharing that with us.
And Tom, for your listeners today, I do have a complimentary first 10 callers or registrants at my website. You'll get a $1,000 coaching package complimentary.
Okay, at theinevitableyou.com.
Inevitable You.
Yep. Well done. Thank you, Bill. And nice little plug there at the end. 866-303-2270. Bob in San Francisco, listening on Green 960. Hey, Bob.
Hi, Tom. It always works with the Bushes to talk about him hitting a triple and or being born on third base and thinking he hit a triple in case
right.
It was bad. Well, this 9/11 put George Bush Jr. on third base, and he wanted to just go to Iraq. But he had a runner in front of him after the attack, and that's how that war happened. He had to drive in the Afghan war, in effect, without overtaking him. So that's the option of war, and apparently it was even after 9/11, Cheney thought it was optional. And the momentum of having Iraq in their sights made them have to do both wars.
Right, and this is why we never went after bin Laden. I mean, excuse me, they were planning They were planning the invasion of Iraq the first week after Bush was installed in the White House by the Supreme Court.
Well, the Suskind forgery shows you they thought they had the yellow cake there. Actually, 6 months before, they even sent Joe Wilson to go check out Niger.
Yeah.
They were going to say that it was there. That's the reference of it that early. And it's only in that forgery.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely right. It's an absolute mess. Bob, thanks a lot for your thoughts on that. Doug in Royal Oak, we got about a minute here. Doug, what's up?
Hey, good afternoon, Tom. Nice to talk with you again. Continuing the baseball analogy, I think you're out for running the bases backwards. So obviously there has to be an umpire to throw George Bush out. But
yeah.
Anyway,
yeah, it's supposed to be called Congress and it's supposed to be called impeachment. But
yeah.
Congress.
Yeah, well, we'll see. I'm close to the John Conyers here in Royal Oak, so hopefully something like that. But
yeah.
You were speaking last week about voter nullification, and I think the only way we can nullify is to nullify ourselves by not going to vote. Don't
yeah.
let these polls
and
fool you.
No, you're absolutely right, Doug. Whether Obama is up or down doesn't matter. Get out there and vote. And right now, make sure that your voter registration is real. You know, check and you can double check. CanIVote.org is the website that the National Association of Secretaries of State put up, and pretty good one it is. It's a reasonable place to start out all those things. So don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Get out there and get active. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit HartmanRadio.com.